sir.
I'll try and make this as condensed as I can, but it's sort of an interesting story. This old guy came in, abdominal pain, high temperature, dehydrated, looked like hell. And my resident called me and says, Alexander, we got this guy here, I got lines going, and we got him on an ice mattress, temperature's about 104 or something. And I said, I'm on my way. And he said, I've alerted the surgery and anesthesiologist and so forth. Well, it was a long time before we could even think about that. But anyway, I had a crew ready to go. And we got him cooled down and hydrated and got his kidneys making urine. And his abdomen, he was, the anesthesiologist, he was on the table. We did this resuscitation, a lot of it in the, after his temperature came down, he was making urine, we put him up to surgery. And we did the rest of it on the operating table. And my anesthesiologist, Kenny, said, I think he says that he's about ready to go. And I said, what I'm going to do is just to infiltrate. I could feel the abdomen, and the gallbladder was sticking up like that.
Wow.
Really, just like a fist. And I said, what I'm going to do is infiltrate the abdominal wall. And you, when I do that, you can give him a little sedation or whatever you want to do safely. This guy's fragile. I'm just going to make an incision over it. And I'm sure with the inflammation that stuck to the abdominal wall, take it out and open the fundus of the gallbladder and anchor it with a couple of Allis clamps and everything, and then get down and, geez, I opened this stuff and the junk came out of it, stones and everything, and bile and pus. And then we scooped out all I could from the gallbladder through this little opening in the fundus, which is a, now just a little opening about that big. And when I was all through, then I took a Depeza catheter and made some extra holes in the flange and put that down there as a big catheter and sewed it to the skin, put it to a bottle and everything. And but that, I'm getting ahead of my story. It was a happy ending. I haven't told you about the ending yet, which was happy. But good on the table, the anesthesiologist said, after all this rigmarole and preparation, he said, okay, Ken, go ahead. So I prepped him, draped him, took the scalpel, picked him up like this. Cardiac arrest. And I said, oh, okay. So threw back the sheets, got up on his chest, pumped him. Pumped his heart and through the sternum. And I didn't think he was going to make it, but we get a Ken, he says, look at the EKG monitor. He says, you're doing good. He says, he's doing good. Okay, I says, well, we got him stable again because he's hypotensive. And we had to get him stable again, making the urine and everything. He says, okay. He says, give it a go. So, I changed gown and gloves,
yeah.
Changed all the things, prepped his abdomen, redraped him and everything. And took the knife again and just touched the skin. I hadn't even made an incision, just started the incision like a cardiac arrest. Sorry, Ken, cardiac arrest. The whole damn thing all over again, all over again. Of course, the guy, hypotensive, his heart isn't working, so I got on and pumped him again. This time it took a little longer, but I'll be damned. We're in business, same thing all over again without going through it all. Prepped the abdomen, redraped him, and made the incision, and was getting down, the gallbladder just popped up like that. I hadn't opened the gallbladder. Cardiac arrest. Third time. This time, I said, bring me the chest kit. He threw off all the gown and everything. I opened his chest. The rib spreader's in place, like this. And through the pericardium, I get his hat around his hand. I could press it like this and watching the monitor while it's reflecting my efforts, everything. Get your hands off for a minute and then. Pretty soon, the other thing goes, for Christ's sake, Senator says he's going to go. He's gone. And we just didn't do a damn thing. I couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe it. And then I had to do my procedure, which was minimal. I mean, I just scooped out the gallbladder, the contents, put the deposit catheter in, and just get the hell out of there. And he was still going well, making urine. I couldn't believe it. And because he's loaded with antibiotics from start go. And the old guy didn't turn a hair. He didn't turn a hair. And geez, he was taking nourishment by mouth in 72 hours.
Wow.
Once his bowels
got
working. And it seems to me he went home in about 10 days or so. Walked out of the hospital.
Wow.
Well, he didn't walk. We didn't let him. Well, put him in a wheelchair, but he was able to walk at bedtime.
That's incredible.
And I said, now be sure and bring him back to see me. I want to see him in 2 weeks. I said, he's doing beautifully well. And I said, I'm so pleased with him. And she said, oh, doctor, she says, we're just so pleased. And he walked into the office 2 weeks later, walked into the office, head held high like this, shook my hand, and I sat him down. And I said, well, Mr. So-and-so, I said, how are you doing? Okay. Wife says, Mike, he's doing well. He's eating and bowels are working. And I said, well, what's that Band-Aid over his eye? And she said, oh, that. He fell off his bicycle yesterday. That's the story Mike related to the the Harvard attorney that interviewed him.
How old was
I don't know if that made any points or not.
How old was this patient?
He was in his 80s. 85.
Wow, that is quite a story.
3 cardiac arrests in an 85-year-old with an infected gallbladder.
Did you do your own ICU care for the patients who are in the intensive care unit or required more special monitoring? Did you do that aspect of care as well, or?
The monitor?
The critical care monitoring.
Oh, critical care monitoring? Right. No, he went right to the ICU, of course.
Yeah.
Went to QCR. But we didn't have a full-time, at that time I did this, we didn't have a full-time cardiologist in there, but doctors, I was down there most of the time.
Gotcha.
Between my other patients, I was down there all the time. But I was amazed he did so well. There wasn't a hell of a lot I'd do. I was feeding him intravenously until his gut became functional. And it was post-operatively, there were no problems.
Do you have any tricks for managing the post-operative ileus? Like how you get the gut waking back up? What would you do in those days for your patients after surgery until... To help encourage the bowel function to return?
I'd just be sure. A lot of guys had tricks they do, feed them prematurely. You can't feed a gut if it's not working. And there are reasons for the ileus. Is it electrolyte imbalance? Is it infection? Is it dehydration? And I'd address all of those things first. I wouldn't get too excited about the ileus. He's not going to probably die of his ileus.
Mm-hmm.
You've got other problems. And that was my outlook and my viewpoint, and every surgeon deals with ileus.
Yeah.
But geez, you've insulted the abdominal cavity. You know, you don't expect that gut to come right back.
That's true.
Yeah. Did you have any experience with this?
Well, there was this one patient that comes to mind in medical school. She was a dear friend of mine, ultimately. But she unfortunately came in with pretty bad bloating and previously healthy. But she was on that admission, she got a CT scan of the abdomen and it showed something suspicious for cancer, suspicious for a uterine.
How old was he?
She was 43, 44.
Okay.
And sure enough, they took her back for a major exploratory laparotomy the next day, and I happened to be there during the surgery.
Exploratory for what?
So they suspect it was with the gynecology oncology team. So they removed her uterus and tubes, and they did.
But this is the day after surgery.
So this is.
What would be?
She came into the hospital bloating, and that's how she was diagnosed with, or that's how she got the CT scan. They thought uterine cancer. They took her to surgery, but during surgery they took some of her bowel because the tumor. It was a leiomyosarcoma. It was invading part of her small intestine, part of the.
So they had to resect that intestine.
So they took out like a 20-centimeter segment of the
primary anastomosis
and put it back together.
So no infection or anything.
No,
all clean surgery.
Yeah. But then, about 8 days go by, and she's not obstipated. She's passing gas, but she hasn't had a bowel movement, and it's going on 9-10 days at one point, and. They don't want to give her any Miralax or any Colace or anything to stimulate the bowels at all or soften the stools because they thought that the anastomosis would break down if you were unduly straining the intestines. I'm curious about what your thoughts are on 10 days after surgery, no stool. Is that concerning for a surgeon's standpoint, or do you just think they look fine otherwise, it'll come back? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, if
it seems like a long time, 10 days.
Some of them do take a long time. Incidentally, any drugs, too. Today, that's one of the things to think about. Is she on any opiates?
Norco and, She was. Mm-hmm. And she had dilaudid PCA.
That's gonna compound the problem.
Exactly. It's a fine line, because she had this big surgical procedure, and she had pain, but...
Yeah. I don't know.
Will you see those anastomoses break down, though? You would do end-to-end, side-to-side anastomoses, I imagine, right?
No. Yeah. Good, clean anastomosis. Yeah. Small bowel, you can do a primary anastomosis because the intestinal content isn't like the colon. You can't do that in the colon. Mm. If that had been the colon, you'd have to do your resection and bring out a
colostomy.
End colostomy and a mucous fistula.
Yeah.
But ileus, I've seen some stuff, but I think you have to be careful not to go off the limb and get so excited yourself. Something has to be done.
Yeah.
It may be that something doesn't have to be done. Just wait it out. Be sure that all the systems are working best you can, and just be patient.
I like that. I'll remember that.
I'm trying to remember. It seems to bring to mind someone, not my case, but someone got gung-ho and explored the abdomen to see if he'd find the cause. It was a dead-end street. I can't remember the details, but I've always been very cool. And that hasn't been a big problem. I've seen it and had to contend with it. But
did you have a favorite surgery that you did?
A favorite one? A
surgical procedure?
I loved it all. I love it. So Miriam knows that. Just like flying. I love it. I miss it. I miss being a doctor. That's why I enjoyed almost 20 years of in rural Maine up there as a family doctor. I mean, that's what I was. And I loved it. I loved the role I played. I always used to tell my residents, don't leave one stone unturned in your diagnosis. Don't let any detail go by during the procedure, if it's surgery, and the post-operative phase. Don't overlook a thing. I've had patients that came through surgery fine and lost them for pulmonary embolism. And I always used to go in and check the calves, and we have all sorts of sophisticated things, ultrasound and to check for deep venous thrombosis, but it's nasty. It can creep up. And I used to tell my residents, this is not a rubber tire. We're not manufacturing rubber tires or making cardboard boxes. This is a patient. It's a precious, precious commodity. And as a doctor, you can't ever forget that. Ever forget it. And the call comes in at 2:00 in the morning. What the hell is it? I don't care what you're doing. You go. Go, go. I can remember one guy, entire abdominal wall, almost barely on fall seal. My resident called me, he says, I got a guy in here, shotgun blast, tangential shotgun blast to the abdomen. He doesn't have any abdominal wall, and I'm looking at a mess. Mm. I said, I'm on my way. This was, I remember, an early morning call. And on the way in, I was trying to figure out just, because he had to have everything shot away, and abdominal wall shot away, and feces and blood and blood loss, and Jesus, I was just going, and I said to myself, you son of a gun, this is what you're trained to do. It's what you're trained to do. This guy was a god-awful mess. He had a defect, a young, healthy guy, about this big, caught in a parking lot, gang warfare. Guy came up and belted him with a shotgun blast, close range, and just blew everything away. And what I was looking at, after I got the sponges and the binder off, was a gaping hole, and you could see small intestine, lot shredded, blood, fecal material, just a god-awful mess. God-awful mess. But he responded to resuscitation, and the blood loss was massive, but we controlled it and got the cleaned up. You got the guy cleaned up, and in that situation, we have a special sheet that's funneled off on each side of the operating table, funneled up and drained into a huge basin, and just poured jugs of water all over him, just to identify the anatomy, get all the crap and the blood out and everything, just loads and loads of it. And I was looking at it, shredded into small intestine. The transverse colon was no longer there. He just had a shredded stump over here at the hepatic flexure, and a shredded stump of colon over here. And I got everything sorted out and resected the stuff that had to be resected, obviously non-viable, and bleeding under control, and the rest of the gut normal, I mean, well, vascularized. And then selecting, matching the bowel up, a small bowel, and cutting away to good tissue with good blood supply, and doing a primary anastomosis, repairing the mesentery and going to the next section. And this guy probably had two or three small bowel anastomoses, and lost quite a bit of small intestine. And then for the colon, I just cleaned that up and cleaned up the ends and brought this end out as a colostomy, and brought this end out as a mucous fistula, just to decompress the bowel like that. And like my little friend Patrick, I didn't have a hell of a lot to close. So you do the best you can. I put a piece, used plastic on him too, and the skin I just tacked out at the edge, and went in twice a day and dressed his wounds and everything. And over a 2-week period, it's always amazed me, Tommy, what the recuperative power of a human body. And this was a young, healthy guy, and in 2 weeks, granulation tissue and laying down fibrous elements and contracting. And I started off with a defect about this, but with skin all tacked out around the edge, and it gradually, came down. Wow. It seems though every couple of days it was getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And eventually, it was small enough so I could get skin over it. And the gut underneath was, and I wasn't concerned about adhesions and bowel obstructions. He's going in through a mess like that, to define the bowel obstructions and fixing it as a nightmare. Anyway, he made it, and I got skin over the thing, and I told the guy, he walked out of the hospital, this was a couple of months later, and I said, I don't have abdominal wall here. And I see underneath that skin is intestine. And I said, you've got to protect that. And especially in your business, we're out trying to kill each other. And I said, you better sort your life out right now, because anyone can slide a knife in that and you're gone. And, okay. And I followed him up to, well, and he finally ended up in the whole side was sort of a puckered scar there. And I had him wear an abdominal binder. And he wasn't anxious to have any more surgery. And I think he'd given up his gang activity. And the last I heard of it, he had another challenge. He came down with pulmonary tuberculosis.
Oh.
But, you know, they can fix that.
Yeah. Wow.
Dude, I miss it. I miss it.
Dude.
Jesus. Well, I was, you know, it's a matter of being productive, but in a very
satisfying
productive,
way.
Constructive way in surgery. There's nothing quite like it. I mean, there's an awful lot of responsibility, but when things go right, you know, it's great. When things go wrong, and you look back and say, Jesus, should I have done this? Should I not have done this? You know, it's a heavy burden, but I remember good advice I had by my chief resident on the old 5th Surgical Service at Boston City Hospital. Jeez, I lost a guy that came in, an old guy again, probably in his 80s, and a GI bleeder, and we got him to the operating table, and he was bleeding from a gastric ulcer at the cardia.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a hell of a time, way up under the diaphragm. It's a hell of a place to see and do anything. And always, either if you can't resect the ulcer, you take a biopsy, because gastric ulcer, always concerned about neoplasia. Anyway, to make a long story short, blood loss was a lot, but I got things all tacked together again. I tried to do an anastomose, the fundus of the stomach, to a loop of intestine.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a Roux-en-Y, I just looped it to a loop of intestines, a jejunum, and get him off the table. But I lost him, and he had him, and it was a surgeon's error. In resecting the bowel, I had devascularized the fundus of the stomach. And I'd made an esophageal gastric fundal anastomosis high up there. It was a good one, but the adjacent tissue wasn't viable. And in retrospect, there's a branch of the esophageal artery that supplies a lot of blood supply to the fundus of the stomach. And that evidently, during my procedure, was compromised. So his anastomosis was compromised and I lost him. And Jesus, at least I feel bad. I've lost people before, but here was something. I in retrospect, I knew what I'd done wrong. I tried to correct it. And I was pretty upset. I was my fifth year. I'd done a lot of surgery, and I had a lot of tough ones. And
how do you?
Well, that wasn't the first patient I lost, but I remember that one in detail. And my guy was my chief resident was a great guy. And he said, Ken, I know you feel bad about that one. He said, that was a tough one. I presented it at rounds. He said, that was a tough one. He said, that could have happened to any of us. I said, Mel, it wouldn't have happened to you. He said, you don't know that, and neither do I. He said, but I'll tell you one thing. Losing a patient is often always painful, especially if you're operating on me. But I'll tell you one thing. Tomorrow morning, you've got patients waiting for you to do your best. They're hopeful that you've got a steady hand and a clear mind. Don't forget that. That reminds me, apropos of one of my favorite poets. I told you, I don't know whether I told you or not, I spent 3 weeks in Iran a few years ago.
Mm-mm. You didn't tell me that, no.
With my buddies.
Khalil Gibran?
Well, I'd known about Omar Khayyam before, and I'd admired his poetry a lot, but I admired it even more after being in Iran and meeting the people. But one of my favorites of his poems is this. You probably are familiar with the first lines. The moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on. Nor all your piety nor wit shall lure it back to cancel half a line, nor all your tears wash away a single word of it. So, there comes a time when you do your best. And every time has to be your best in surgery. Every time has to be your best. And then you learn from it and go on to your next patient who's depending on it to be pretty sharp.
It sounds exceedingly stressful. The life of a surgeon sounds exceedingly stressful. These are, you know, my wife being an OB-GYN resident, she does a lot of surgery. Hysterectomies, various things. Nevertheless, it's an additional aspect of residency training. It's a stressor that she has that I have no idea. I really know nothing about, because she's in charge. She's the one with the scalpel. She makes the first incision. You know,
because surgery oftentimes is very, very stressful. But I never minded the stress. I was aware of it, but I'm being extra cautious, aware of the stress. But I usually had confidence that I could handle the situation. I've seen surgeons absolutely fly off the handle. I remember I was scrubbed in at surgery. I had fifth year surgery rotation at Beth Israel Hospital in the Harvard service there. And it was it was an excellent hospital. But this surgeon was doing a total gastrectomy. And he had an abundance of assistants, including this medical student. And I couldn't see anything, and my face was jammed against his sweating axilla on his right, and I couldn't breathe. And this was a 5-hour procedure, and at times I said, you son of a bitch, I'm going to do it. Stay there. And a couple hours into the surgery, and he was bitching and swearing, and he was a egotistical guy, a good surgeon, but Jesus, he gave everyone hell. And at this time, he stood up like this, I guess, for the nurse to take a sponge and wipe his forehead, and he swung around with his elbow like this and flattened my nose. And together with the retractor and my state of mind, I went down to the operating room floor with a big clatter. And what did this God's gift to surgery do? He turned around and he says, you have contaminated my elbow.
Oh, oh Jesus.
I had a few thoughts about 30, but the bug is it. But I've seen other surgeons. I saw one surgeon when I was a student. This was at, I remember, Quincy City Hospital. He was an Irishman and a lovable guy, but in the surgery, he was an ogre. Tense. And I was scrubbed in with him on, I forget the procedure, I think it was a gallbladder or something, and he kept, hemostat, give me your hemostat, and he kept getting his hemostat stuck. It just hadn't been cleansed properly, and he couldn't unsnap the thing, and he got one. Throw it away. Nurse, give me a hemostat that worked. She could get another one. He didn't say thank you. I kept going. And the second one, God damn, this thing, it doesn't work. And he slammed it on the floor. And he got a third one. I couldn't believe it. This one he couldn't open. And he took it, left the operating room table, and took that thing and flung it across the room. That wasn't enough. You know, the wash station, sterile sheet, and then the basin it with water, you put the dirty instruments, everything. He strode across the floor purposely and came up to that thing and with his leg, his foot, kicked it up the stand. And all of us in the audience looked, and the pan went up in the air, spilling bloody water all over hell, turned slowly, emptied all the dirty hemostats over, and hit the floor with a great clang.
Oh, my goodness.
And everyone was silent. Not a word. Not a word from the surgeon. He stalked back to the table. And I said, Jesus, what an ass. What a horse's ass.
I hear stories about surgeons throwing instruments or hitting you on the hand with an instrument if you're not retracting well enough.
That never happened to me.
But what is it that some surgeons do that and some surgeons don't? Why is that?
It used to be a, speaking of what, the surgeon abusing the assistant. There was a magazine intern or something designed for medical students. And after this incident, I used to like to draw cartoons. I used to like to sketch them. And I drew a cartoon of a surgeon at the table, and something was going wrong, and he, was chastised the assistant. And so it shows the surgeon with scissors cutting off the fingers of the assistant's hand. They're just stumps there, blood dripping into the wound. And I said, it's just a bit left the hell, it was published.
Really?
Yeah. I've got it someplace in myself. But this was when I was a student. I submit that a long time ago. Yeah. And I've heard of having knuckles wrapped. I never saw that. But I did see these other things which I have described in probably too much detail to you, so be thankful you're not going into it. But there again, you know, it's, people are different. People like that really shouldn't be in surgery. Yeah. They shouldn't be in surgery. They shouldn't never have done it.
Yeah.
So.
Well.
Yeah, damn, I haven't finished my beer yet. I'm going to stop talking. Talk to me for a while, Tommy.
I can't quite regale you with stories such as those. I will say that you were asking about Spain earlier.
Yes.
I was studying abroad in Spain, and the whole discussion about surgery, I think, is relevant here, because as soon as I arrived to Spain, I got sick about 5 or 6 days later.
You were sick?
Awfully sick.
Oh.
And I thought, well, I'm just going to stay at home and not go to class. But I got worse and worse and worse. And so I went to the hospital. And this is when I was an undergraduate, mind you, so I had no medical training, but they pressed on my right lower abdomen, and when they took their hand off, I wanted to punch the guy. I thought,
rebound tenderness.
And I instantly knew, having no anatomy training or anything before, I had appendicitis. I don't know how I knew that, but that rebound tenderness is real. Anyways, I get taken back for surgery after I very naively request being transferred back to the United States for surgery. I ask if they can fly me back to California, if you could imagine that. But I get taken back, taken care of so well by the surgeon for the next several days, make a wonderful recovery and go home, that it's that experience in the hospital. I was actually laying in the hospital bed when I decided I wanted to go to medical school. I didn't choose surgery, of course, but that was the moment I thought, I want to be there, because I was terrified. Didn't really speak the language as well as I would have liked, and it was in a new place, and I was, you know, going under the knife. But this way the doctor...
But they took good care of you.
...handled everything and kind of put me at ease, I thought, I want to do that for people in the future.
Yeah.
So that's...
Good.
That's where I come from. But so I understand the importance of not being a jackass.
It's right, concerning rebound tenderness.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I've ever elicited the sign of rebound tenderness, because in medical school, I forget where it was, I was taught that when you're looking for a peritoneal irritation, which this signifies, equates with peritoneal irritation, instead of rebound tenderness, which can be very painful, witness you nearly want to kill this guy, percussion tenderness. Put a finger, put a digit over the and tap lightly like that, and they'll tell you if it hurts.
Oh.
No rebound tenderness.
And this is a gentler way of eliciting
percussion,
the same.
Percussion tenderness. And you describe this, you know, percussion tenderness, right lower quadrant, reproducible. Every time I do that and everything else matches, he's got appendicitis or something.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'll do that. I did not know that.
Percussion tenderness.
Where did you do residency?
Boston. In on the Fifth Surgical Harvard service. That's a story about OBIN. I wanted to tell you. I was got my interview, and they had Boston had three university services: Boston University, Tufts, and Harvard. And I was interviewed by, seemed to me there was a, because I don't remember, I just remember two people, but it seemed to me the three schools got together and had a committee, that, and then they worked out who was going to go to which service. Yeah. And I remember I was standing outside the door when a good friend of mine, he was a classmate in medical school, at Tufts. I went to Tufts, and he wanted to go to a general surgery, but he liked OB just like I did too, and I was in a quandary about it myself a little bit. I loved OB, and it was so happy and everything, and a lot like surgery, because it involves surgery and long hours and so forth. And I was right outside the door, and I could hear the conversation. And he said, Dr. Palmer, he answered a lot of those routine stuff. Do you realize you've got 5 years of training in surgery ahead of you? He said, do you have any concern about this? Second thoughts? Did you have any other goal in mind? And Tom said, well, I'll tell you, I liked OBJYN a lot, and he said, he torpedoed himself.
Oh no.
He said, you know, Dr. Palmer, are you sure you want to go to surgery? 5 years of surgery, and it's not easy. I'm ready to put in the 5 years. Well, are you sure you want to be in surgery? Well, I'm pretty sure. I was cringing for him. Jeez, I was cringing for him. And one of the doctors said, Dr. Palmer, he said, you just finished 4 years of medical school, and now the last couple of years loaded with clinical things. I think it's time probably for you to have a good idea where you're going to go. And that'll be all.
didn't do surgery?
Okay, the next one, candidate, center. He said, he asked me, he said, Dr. Center, he said, you got a long road ahead. Do you know what you want to do? I said, I want to be a surgeon. And he said, is there any doubt in your mind? Not one bit. And I got on the Harvard service. They're all good, all University services, but Jesus, funny how things work out. But at other times, I can think of interviews I've had for other things. Back when I was a wet behind the ears punk for medical school, and I really gave some pretty stupid answers. I cringe when I think of them. I don't think about them anymore.
How many residents were in your class in residency? How many of the...
You mean for surgery?
Yes. Each year, how many?
Each year, there were... there were five of us. Hmm. It's a five-year program. And what they tried to do is to go up, but guys would peel off second or third year. Gotcha. Some in general surgery would peel off into orthopedic surgery. Some would peel off into plastic surgery.
Did you do any vascular surgery yourself?
What?
Did you do any vascular surgery yourself?
Only emergency surgery. Okay. Yeah, we had training in it, but I didn't do any electively. No.
Gotcha.
No, I didn't.
So when you were in Boston, let's see, the cardiologist Samuel Levine must have been there. Did you ever cross paths with him?
What was his name?
Sam Levine.
Oh, yes.
Levine.
Yes.
The cardiologist.
Samuel Levine. He was at Beth Israel.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, Sam Levine. Yeah, he was a big figure in Boston.
Was he?
Yeah. Did your paths cross with him?
I just read one of his
Now, he was
books.
My, that's a long time ago.
Yeah,
I'm surprised if you crossed paths with him that he's still...
I just read one of his books recently.
Oh, I see. Yeah. By that way.
Yeah. And Richard Clark Cabot, the physical exam, physical diagnosis.
Well, Boston is full of the Cabots.
Yeah. Oh, is it a big family?
Yeah. Well, from the colonial days, yeah. They were very active commercially and politically. Yeah.
So what were your hours like as a resident? Did you ever have time to do anything on your own?
Two out of three nights. We had every day. And
you worked?
But we had, as chief resident, you'd have the break. There were three surgical services with a chief for each service. And at times when there was a golf tournament, but a party or something to get away, you could sign off by prearrangement with the chief, and we'd rotate being chief of the three services.
Wow.
One out of three. So one out of three, you'd be chief for the entire services. And
one out of three nights?
Nights, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you worked every day, too.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was there wasn't a lot of time.
But my chief resident, I had so much affection for this guy. He said, Ken, he said, you've been up all night. He said, I want you to take off. Don't come to morning rounds. He said, go and get some sleep. Get a good breakfast. Go to sleep. We'll see you this afternoon.
Wow. What was his name?
Yeah, he was a good resident.
What was his name?
What?
His
Melvin Osborne.
Melvin Osborne?
Yeah. He was, and went to University of Nebraska and Harvard Medical School. And soon out of Harvard, out of medical school, a war came along and he went overseas as a physician and came back. And he was so smooth. As a speaker, he had people eating out of his hands. Everyone loved the guy. He was a handsome guy. He married a beautiful woman from Costa Rica, I think. Well, all Spanish blood. She lineage went way back to the conquistadores. And Nice, nice family. But geez, I worship that guy. He was so damn smart. And he didn't, he was just good. I told you the episode about when he boosted my spirits.
Yes.
When I
felt
so bad.
That was him?
That's the kind of a guy. That was he. Yeah.
Wow.
He's a great guy.
Where did he end up practicing?
He practiced at the Peter Bent Brigham Hospital.
He stayed there?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And a couple of other hospitals in Boston. He was much sought after.
So where were you going to go on a hike tomorrow?
We're going to hike.
Where at?
We're going to go up northeast. Scott, I got a map. Yeah, I'll show you. So.